May we hear with our ears what is auspicious. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious. May we enjoy with strong limbs and bodies the life allotted to us. This is a lecture which was given by Swami Ashokananda on Sunday, June 14th, 1953, and the title is Cover Everything with God, which of course refers to the Isha Upanishad, considered the oldest of the known Upanishads. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. That means by Isha, by the Lord, by the divinity. Vasyam is to be covered, is to be clothed. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. All this is to be covered with the Lord. That is the beginning of this Upanishadic verse. Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. All this is to be covered with God. All this is to be seen within God. Yat Kincha Jagatyam Jagat, whatever moves, whatever moves in this world is to be seen as immersed with God, as contained within God, within that infinite reality. So that is the verse, and the lecture by Swami Ashokananda refers to that verse. It was given on June 14th, 1953. Cover everything with God is a quotation from one of the Upanishads, which, as you know, are the original texts of the Vedanta philosophy and religion. Of these, there is a rather short but very ancient one in the Samaveda called the Ishavasya Upanishad. It is so called because it begins with the word Ishavasya, meaning by Ish, by the Lord. Vasyam is to be covered, everything. This is a translation of that verse from the Sanskrit, namely, everything in this changing world should be covered with the Lord. This should be enjoyed, this world that is, should be enjoyed by renouncing it, which is an interesting idea and can be a source of great meditation just by itself. This Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam, this world is to be renounced, is to be enjoyed by renouncing it. Do not cover anybody's wealth. So that is the original verse. Now here's Swami Ashokananda's comment on that. Strangely enough, although the truth embodied in this text was understood and discovered in Vedic India, it took quite a long time to become one of the most important teachings of Indian religion. At least 2,000 years later, it found, I should say, its full blossoming in the teachings embodied in the Bhagavad Gita. You remember, no doubt, that a greater part of that book, that is the Gita, is devoted to the delineation of Sri Krishna's teaching called Karma Yoga, the path of union with God or God realization through action. This Upanishad contains the very essence of Karma Yoga. And I recommend to you an intensive study of that little book. I'm sorry to say that in places it is rather obscure. Even commentators have puzzled over it. And everybody has made an attempt, who has made an attempt. You see, a cogent explanation requires that every word be given its right meaning in accord with the essential theme of the whole text, and that is where some difficulties have arisen. It doesn't matter, however, if we get the general idea. This is an extraordinary book, because in one sense it teaches the partial reality of the world and our existence here. In another sense, it explains our identity with Brahman, the absolute, the reality, and is therefore a philosophical negation of anything that is relative or anything that is finite. I shall have to explain from both points of view this strange expression, namely, in quotations, cover everything with the Lord. Isha vasyam idam sarvam. By Isha is by means of, each by means of the Lord. Vasyam is to be covered. Isha vasyam idam this sarvam all. Very brief statement, but start of an extensive philosophy. Some of us have arrived through reasoning at the conclusion that behind this world is a God who is infinite and eternal, and we may even think that this God is immanent in the universe and pervading everything. But in actual experience, we do not really feel the presence of God. Our experience is of something other than God, which we call this material world. In this material world, we see some aspects of life and some evidence of intelligence, particularly as it exists in human beings. And in these, we also are aware of something which we call self-consciousness. This self-consciousness cannot be explained as the product of anything else. Everything else has to be explained in and through this self-consciousness. But by and large, we perceive this reality as mechanical, as material. It is no wonder that in every country there has been a persistent effort throughout the ages to explain life, to explain intelligence and consciousness as byproducts of matter. Well, now that is what we are faced with. On one side, we are convinced that there must be somewhere a universal being whom we call God, who is perfect. On another side, in our personal experience, we are rather aware of the opposite. We are aware of the world of matter. How to reconcile the two entities, we do not know. We are placed, as it were, between these opposite kinds of reality. And although sometimes we would like to extricate ourselves from material reality, we do not at once succeed. Nor are we always aware of the existence of that divine reality. When a person is convinced that there is a God, however, he is faced with a practical problem. Perhaps he takes the attitude that his fulfillment is not in this material world, but in the world of the spirit, in God. He says, what I should do is to hasten my progress toward the spiritual reality and know God more and more, so that eventually I shall succeed in knowing God fully, as God is in himself. There is always the supposition that in such knowing, there will be an utter satisfaction, not only complete in its measure, but also everlasting. This supposition has been confirmed by the experience of many saints and sages of whom we have heard. When we see a person transformed, dwelling in infinite peace, manifesting a sense of freedom and fearlessness and a wisdom, purity, and selflessness which we cannot even dream of, I think we are convinced that this supposition is not altogether wrong, that if we ever attain to God, we shall thereby attain also to infinite perfection and everlasting fulfillment. Others have thought that we cannot just ignore, at least in our present estimate, such a considerable portion of reality as this material world indicates. These are impelled by their philosophical reasoning to reconcile this world to the spiritual being or God. You all know how this effort has been made in its extreme form, as in monistic Vedanta, where it is said that the material world does not really exist. There has always been the spirit, and the world has really never been. If you remind them that we actually experience the world and therefore we cannot deny its existence, they answer that it is true we experience many things which we cannot be sure exist, such as dreams and hallucinations. If you say there must be a basis for these experiences, they will tell you that the basis is the experiencer himself or herself. Otherwise, you should be able, when you wake up, to find some remnant of the world you have within a dream, but there is nothing. Not even a few grains of dust are left. Of course, you may be left with a palpitating heart, depending on the dream experience, that is true. But you have to admit that the experience had no other basis than within yourself. Well, such people say that the whole world, this material world, is actually no more real than the dream world. It has no more reality in it than you yourself, who are its reality. If you still ask them the question, then why should there be a dream or an illusory experience at all? They say that whatever your explanation may be, you cannot conclude that either the dream or the illusion was real. Yes, some explanation is called for, and sometimes we are able to explain why we dream, but no one has been able to explain why we see an illusion. The reason is that as long as one is having the illusion, one is of course incapable of explaining it. When a dreaming person asks about his dream, his question is part of the dream, not an actual experience, a waking experience. In the same way, when in the philosophical quest you ask whether or not the world is real, this question is still part of your own illusion. It is not a genuine question. How can you expect a genuine answer to such a question? And I don't think that you want an illusory answer. If I preface my answer by saying, now look here, I can give you an answer, but don't expect it to be a real answer, then you will say, well, then I don't want such an answer at all. Further, even when an answer is found to this tremendous question, it cannot be expressed in the ideas and words which belong to the world of illusion. If you ask, cannot anything be communicated? Yes, in some sense, the answer is communicated. You know the story of how Swami Vivekananda came to Sri Ramakrishna, and on his second visit, when the master touched him over his heart, he saw the whole world whirling into nothingness. As if by a magic wand, the world of illusion had been dispelled. And the disciple, that is Swami Vivekananda, cried out to Sri Ramakrishna, oh, what are you doing to me? He was still in his teens at that time and of an exceedingly affectionate nature. And so this cry arose from his heart. Then Sri Ramakrishna touched him again and said, all right, we shall wait. Afterwards, on many occasions, he would tell that story in front of Swami Vivekananda. Sri Ramakrishna would tell that story in front of Swami Vivekananda to the Swami's great embarrassment. Sometimes when a worthy disciple comes who is ready for the highest spiritual experience, the teacher at once gives it to him. And it is generally understood that Sri Ramakrishna, recognizing that Swami Vivekananda was such a disciple, wanted to communicate that experience to him. In such a case, no words are necessary. The living experience is brought home to the disciple, and there is no question of doubting or reasoning. When you experience a clear perception of truth, that is your best proof. And here is a clear perception of truth that was given to him. One cannot say, therefore, that no answer can be given. It is a strange proposition that we are asked to cover everything with God. That is the first verse of this Upanishad, Isha Vasyam Idam Sarvam. By God, by Ish, that is the Lord, all this is to be covered. What this covering means, what we should do to accomplish the process of covering everything, gilding everything with God, and what changes are involved in the process, all these questions have to be discussed. Sometimes the answers may sound extreme, and to some of you even unrealistic. But you should remember that these propositions have not been arrived at through speculation. These propositions are statements of actual experiences. To go back then to this problem that I was discussing, one solution, as I've said, is to ignore the material world. Since God is the one who will satisfy us, we shall find our satisfaction only in God. We go to God just as a child rushes home to his parents and is happy. Yes, there are other homes and parents, but he has no concern. The child has no concern with them. He wants his own parents. And there he finds his security. People who have taken this position go to God, and whatever and whether or not this world exists, they just don't care. Another way is to make peace somehow between the world and God. Since our reason will not be satisfied with ignoring such a vast slice of reality. And the extreme position is to deny the reality of this world at all, to say it is an illusion and that only God exists. But there is also an intermediate position, that this world is real, but it is dependent on God. Our souls are fragments of God, just as a tongue of flame is part of the fire, or a wave is part of the sea. Without the fire or the ocean, the flame or the wave could not exist. Nevertheless, it has a distinct, separate existence. Sometimes, other philosophers have quarreled with those who maintain this position and have said, if you believe there is this infinite reality, God, how can you at the same time maintain that there are distinctive existences such as souls and this world? Such people reply, oh yes, I can do it. Well, how do they do it? After you boil down all their arguments, you find that all they say is, I'm doing it. Who would not admit that there are individual realities? At the same time, who would not admit that the world and individuals have only an illusory existence? Yet the philosophers who have taken the middle position maintain that they have a distinctive existence, logic or no logic. In any case, the practical problem is still there. Whether we believe that this world exists independently and will always be here, even when we realize God, or if we say that this world and the beings in it are dependent realities with distinctive existence, or if we say these are really illusory, although at the present time we may think they actually exist, the practical problem is that we are bound up with them and cannot throw them off this dream of or illusion. We are obsessed by it. Or knowing they are dependent on divine realities, we give them some reality. We give them more reality than we should accord to something that is dependent. If this world is dependent upon God, then God, not this world, should be prominent in our consciousness. But actually the world is the more prominent in reality in our experience. So the practical problem is, how can we set ourselves right? No matter which philosophical view has won our allegiance, for a long time our problem is how to become extricated from the clutches of the world that we normally experience, that is to say, phenomena or relative realities. If you have taken the extreme view, you will always feel uncomfortable about recognizing an illusion to be real. Nobody wants to do something if he feels that what appears to be real to him is nothing but his own fantasy. If you think things have some reality, you still do not want to be so mixed up with them that you have no independence. Nor do you want to perceive them in this reverse fashion, according these values that they do not have, and ignoring what is most valuable. So there is this big problem of freedom or liberation. The need for freedom has given rise to many practical teachings, and of these, probably the most important is the ancient teaching of this Upanishad, Ishavasyam Idam Sarvam, cover everything with God, which, as I mentioned, was revived by Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita and described as Karma Yoga. If you are philosophically convinced that God is all that is, all that exists, he is both transcendental, God is both transcendental and immanent in it, then not even a grain of dust could exist unless it were substantiated by the divine substance, imbued with the divine substance. If you're convinced of it, of course, then you would say, yes, I want to cover everything with God. And if you are not convinced that the essence or substance of everything is God, but you say that God is ruling everything from outside, or that he is ruling from within, seated in the heart of everything, even from these standpoints, this is a necessary practice. Let us start from the lower point of view, that God has created this material world and the world of mind or life. He lords it over everything in time and space, but he is not in any of those things. That is generally the position of the dualistic or Semitic religions. There you cover everything with God by relating it to God. You say, thy will be done in heaven and in earth. Can you think of anything happening in defiance or of indifference or ignorance of the will of God? No, nothing can ignore the will of God. That is why in every religion obedience is taught. Obedience is the faculty of training our mind to look up to something superior recognizing that our will is not paramount. It is the greatest of all our illusions that we have freedom of will. We have nothing of the kind. Would you go up to the roof of your house and just drop off and start flying? No. You have to take into consideration the laws of physics pertaining to your weight and to your artificial wings, whatever you may have devised. Only in obedience to these laws that govern the motion of a body can you throw yourself into empty space and fly. It is always so. But you see, in many of the intimate things of our life, we think that we can do whatever we like. Yes, if we try to live up to the higher laws which grant larger scope to our functioning, we can become free of the operation of the more binding lower laws. But always from one law to another, we have to go. Those who take this dualistic or dualistic view have been taught the practice of thinking everything happens in accordance with the Lord's will. Mohammedans, for instance, make much of obedience to Allah. Whatever happens, they bow before Him and say, "It is the will of Allah, be it as the Lord wishes." With such people, this is what we is meant by covering everything with God. If honor has come, it is the gift of the Lord. Dishonor is equally the gift of the Lord. Hope, happiness or misery, life or death, wealth or poverty, whatever comes is the Lord's gift. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, it is said, from fear of him, fear of that reality, the wind blows. That is a rather deistic view, that everything happens according to the will of the Lord. Those who want to live according to this belief have to impress this fact first of all upon their mind. You may say, how can they do it if they are not convinced? Do you need proof that everything is in accordance with God's will? All right, this is the way to prove it. Think that it is so. Believe that it is so. To see a thing, you must turn your face in the right direction. Don't be like the person who says, no, I won't turn my face to look at the east unless you first convince me that I will see something there. Well, the only answer to him is to take hold of his head and turn it quickly toward the east. If you ask who will do it, ah, friends, God has a well-balanced machine in this universe. The time comes when either men or nature will make him turn toward the east. He is like a little boy who quarreled with his mother and refused to eat his breakfast. He ran away, but she knew how to bring her child under control. She wouldn't ask him to come back and eat. Well, after all, one gets hungry. Half an hour, 1 hour, 2 hours went by. By the time this child was very hungry, and yet he had his pride. He wouldn't just come back and ask for his breakfast. So he wrote with a piece of charcoal, "If you ask me once more, I shall come." This is how nature does it for us. It will wrench our head around and make us look toward the east. Everyone will share in these truths one time or another. Why do you think they are for everybody, that these truths are meant for everybody at once? It is a false idea that by hook or by crook you must push a person toward religion. He does not become religious that way. He just becomes meek. That is to say, he loses his spirit and simply mumbles his prayers. But a time will come for him when he will go in spirit, strong, eagerly seeking for religion. The Lord will manage it. If you want to be intellectual about it, you can start with the idea that this world is a cosmos. a unified existence, an organic unity. It cannot be that all things are entirely separate entities. How is it that we perceive this whole universe as a whole, as one entity? And how is it that things seem to be interrelated? If they were really actually separate from one another, there would be unbridgeable gaps between things and no unifying laws operating among them at all. So there must be a unity somewhere, and it must be intelligent. There must be at least the possibility of consciousness in that unity, the possibility of a Jesus Christ or a Buddha must be there. And that wonderful unity is God. It is reasonable to start with the idea that God is a conscious entity. And since there is a system by which everything happens according to rules or laws, then it happens according to the will of God. You see, what I want to tell you in this connection is this. If you want to see a thing which is in the east, you should start by turning your face to the east and not just go on looking toward the west. Insisting somebody must prove to you that it is in the east. In all spiritual matters, as in science, proving depends on preparation. Just as you prove the necessary instruments and conditions, just as you produce the necessary instruments and conditions before you start a scientific experiment, in this spiritual experiment, too, you prepare for it by conditioning yourself. The instruments, in this case, are your mind and your body. It is also your conduct and your character. You arrange them in a certain way. That is what is meant by spiritual discipline. That is what is meant by conditioning the body and mind. Then the real experience for proving the divine reality can be started. There is nothing unscientific or irrational about it. Why do you expect to remain as you are, thinking all different thoughts in which there may be no rhyme, no reason, and then behaving foolishly? I am more and more convinced that we all, in some way, are insane. There is no rationality in us. Well, every insane person is also rational when he utters two words together, if you don't listen to the other words. I have told you the story of a man who was shut up in an asylum. The doctor in charge had a young relative visiting him who talked with this inmate and found he was quite rational, quite normal. So the young man went to the doctor and asked, "Why did you shut this person up in this institution? This man is quite normal." "Oh, is he? Come on," the doctor said. They went to the inmate and the doctor said, "You want to go away? How will you go?" So the man answered, "Why, I shall jump from one treetop to another treetop." The doctor said, "You see, that is the man. That is the one thing wrong with him. If I let him go, he will climb a tree and jump from the top of it. We're all very rational up to a point. But if we are taken as a whole, we find that we are absolutely irrational people. And believe me, there actually comes a time in spiritual life when a person finds he is, as it were, coming out of a fit of insanity into the world of real sanity. Here we take the unreal to be real, the momentary to be eternal. Here we think that a thing which does not exist is existing, and that which is existing we ignore completely. You think that is sanity? It is not. To be told we are in this peculiar position is certainly not a great support to our morale, I know, but just helping us in continuing our insanity is also not beneficial. This is the situation we're in. So we have to condition ourselves by disciplining our mind and our body. When the devotee says everything is God's doing, everything, and feels that he cannot take a single step unless it is willed by God, his position is not just inferential. A person who is established in this practice actually sees the ever-present will of God in everything, however small or large. He feels the actual conscious operation of the divine will behind everything. For him, everything has been covered by the Lord, as the Upanishad says. Of course, by that time, he no longer is interested in what God does, that he makes the ant move or the bird to fly. He is interested in God as he is in himself. So he ends by saying that the creation is God's Aishwaryam, that is his glory, which is separate from him. If the queen loves the king, then when she thinks of him, her whole heart is focused on him and set and not in his kingdom. Yet she recognizes that the kingship is his glory. And so the devotee recognizes that God is the only thing and all his omnipotence, his lordship, is his glory. All dualistic religions teach that doctrine. Now, when we come to the theists who give the universe a dependent existence, we find that they think God is controlling this universe from inside as well as outside. That view, which seems to many to be more reasonable than the dualistic view, has been called in Vedanta, as you well know, Vishishtadvaita, that is to say, qualified monism. It is qualified because it accords reality to God and holds that all other things are derived or dependent realities, which, as it were, qualify him, just as the red coat of a man puts, that the man puts on in his, is his qualification, his adjective. They say God is the only doer, seated in the heart of those who are living and the non-living. He controls everything. If in an organic substance, for example, you find a center of domination, of self-control, you recognize that it has a certain inner being. They say that everything has an inner center from which all its powers flow, which holds it under control and makes it react to all other beings according to certain patterns. This center is called the Antaryamin, the inner controller, he who rules from within, the inner controller. Because God rules from within, he has been called the soul of our souls. God is seated in our heart and according to his own will is making everything in us move. God is ruling our body and mind. If, however, we were constrained only from within and not from outside, the universe could not be held together, so God is considered to be the Antaryamin, the inner controller of this universal reality. Just as we have individual souls, individual intelligence, mind, life, senses, and body, so this universal soul has a universal or cosmic intelligence and mind. The universe made up of the 14 planes, as it is said, is his cosmic body. And there is also cosmic life. In both these ways, God controls everything. If you ask the philosophers of this school about the substance of the world and the souls, you find different shades of optimism, different shades of opinion. But in general, they agree that you can say, yes, these are practically the being of God. Just as the limited space in a jar is the same as the space in the vast sky, or a branch of a tree is of the same wood as the trunk, so all things are of the same nature as that divine reality. There's no difference in kind. Nevertheless, they say all these distinctions will remain forever. You will find that people who follow this school and those who follow the dualistic school are all devotional in attitude and come to the same conclusion. We should continually subordinate ourselves to God, accepting the fact that everything, inside or outside us, happens according to God's will. Then, being devoted to God in utter love, we shall realize our union with Him. You must admit that all these schools accord reality to this phenomenal universe. Well, let us go a little further and look at another school, which you read of in the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna. You do not know whether to call it monistic or qualified monistic. Sri Ramakrishna continually used to say, God has become all these beings. He has also become this material universe. Now, there is a little difference between this view and the qualified monistic view. The qualified monist will never say, I am God, nor will he say another person is God, appearing in the form of a man. You see, there are people who find it very difficult to think that a man or a bird or a beast is essentially God himself. However devout they are, they do not like this teaching. Whether they know it or not, they are following specifically what is called the qualified monistic view. According to this other view, which is somewhat superior to that, the person looking through the eyes of a man, the person walking with these feet, is actually that divine reality. God has become all these beings. From a very ancient time, this view has prevailed. In the hymn to the universe of being in the Rig Veda, it is said, He is the being with 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet. Thousand, the word thousands here stands for a large number, an infinite number. In another experience of the same category, every portion of this universal being is seen as a distinct form of God. You see the same thing appearing in every form, as it were. You're standing in a room where the walls are covered by mirrors, and whichever way you look, you see only one form reflected. Well, this is not your form, but the divine form, the divine being that has been reflected in every form. Just as you see your friend in different clothing from time to time, but you know that it is the same person, and it is not the clothes that make the difference. This is the important factor, your memory and perception. In the same way, you actually recognize that is what remains in your consciousness. It is God, it is He, the one being, who has put all these forms. There is no other. Then the mind becomes silent. In this Ishavasya Upanishad that we quoted, it is said, there is no grief, no delusion, when you see everywhere the same being. Our total experience is made up of our delusion and grief. All our articulations are because of delusion and grief. Delusion makes us see wrongly and clamor for wrong things, and grief makes us regret the wrong things we have done or experienced. Therefore, when a person sees the one being in all forms, there can be no more grief and no more delusion, and so utter silence, utter reality prevails.